Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so more details emerging from the life and times of the person who has now reportedly confessed that he was indeed the shooter at the 4th of July parade in Highland Park that killed seven and wounded another 45.
Yes, and 83 rounds were fired in total.
So we've got a confession, according to the reporting. And now we have the family talking both directly as well as through spokes lawyers. Let's start with directly. Dad. Dad tells the New York Post that he and his son were talking about mass shootings the day before his son committed a mass shooting in Highland Park. He goes, yeah, that guy's an idiot. That's what he said. The dad recalled his son saying of the Denmark shooter. You know, you saw the story over the weekend about this guy who opened up at a mall outside of Copenhagen. So dad said, yeah, that guy's an idiot. That's what he said. The father said his son added people like that who commit mass shootings to amp up the people who want to ban all guns. I talked to him 13 hours before the 4th of July massacre. That's why I guess I'm in such shock. Like, did he have a psychiatric break or something? Said dad.
I'm not believing dad. Are you? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And one more thing from dad, because, of course, the question we have is 3 months after his son was labeled a clear and present danger by police who responded to a call to the home because the allegation was that the confessed shooter had threatened to kill family members. Why did he sponsor him for a FOID card? He didn't see any clear and present danger, even though that's how police described his son.
Yeah, and Highland Park Police sent a clear and present danger report to Illinois State Police.
Dad,
but we'll get into that later.
Dad said of that, the incident and then the confiscation of a sword, a dagger, 15 knives subsequent to that incident and police response was, quote, just a childish outburst, unquote.
Oh, really?
The knives were just a collection, quote, unquote. You know, I used to collect coins and baseball cards. That's what the dad said of the weapon collection of his son.
And he got the weapons back, by the way, because he claimed that they were his and not his son's. That's what we learned yesterday from Cavelli.
He said he decided to sponsor his son's firearm because he thought his son was going to use the weapon to go to the shooting range. He bought everything on his own and they're registered to him, dad says, trying to separate himself from what the son did. You know, he drove there, he ordered them, he picked them up. They did his background check on each one. He had, and he insists that despite questions and criticisms of him, he had zero involvement in the massacre that occurred on Monday. They make me like I groomed him all to do this. I've been here my whole life and I'm going to stay here, hold my head up high because I didn't do anything wrong. Dad didn't do anything wrong. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Police reports don't lie. You can get a copy. Anybody out there can get a copy of the police report. I want to send one to Steve Greenberg, his attorney, because I called him again last night and said, what the heck are you doing? What is this game that you're playing with the media? If you're going to lie, don't go and don't let your client talk to the media. And don't you go on national news because, you know, he doesn't want to do local. He wants the big time. He wants the free publicity. Listen to this lie. Are you ready? This is Tom Yamas from NBC News talking to attorney Steve Greenberg.
People are upset with the alleged shooter's parents. They're telling me, how did they not know something like this wasn't going to happen? Do the parents in this situation bear some responsibility?
We could always look at an event and then in hindsight say, oh, these were the warning signs. There is no history of him ever engaging in a single violent act. It's easy to say now, well, the parents should have known. But the fact is that nobody knew. Nobody saw anything because there was nothing to see.
Nothing to see?
Yeah. I appreciate the call for restraint in terms of Monday morning quarterbacking these things. But I'm not suggesting criminal liability based on what we know. But I mean, both mom and dad, they saw some things. They saw some things.
They felt threatened enough to call police.
And, you know, the conversation he relays that he had with his son the night before this occurred. Okay, but there's just so many things that are coming out now. He posted on the forum documenting reality under the moniker Awake 47. He posted about this relationship he has with a teenage sex doll he called Sophie.
And his fascination with 47. I mean, he had 47 tattooed on his face. He also drove around a car with 47 on it.
Well, so what? What does that mean?
Here's what it means.
He had some type of affinity towards the number 4 and 7, and inverse was 7-4.
July 4th, the date he chose to do something.
Okay.
Well, if your son tattoos something on your face, you might want to ask him what that means.
Yeah. When did he get the tattoo, and how long had he been planning to do something on July 4th? Do we know that?
We don't know.
Right.
I mean, they said that he'd been planning the attack for months. That's first. That is.
And when did he get the tattoo?
Probably. I have no idea.
Right. The numerology is a lot less interesting than his conduct. I mean, that's part of his conduct, but we don't know. What we do know is about teenage sex dolls. We do know on Call of Duty there were accounts of him, his character in Call of Duty, shooting from an elevated position. We do know what happened at his home in July 19th, at least, or in the fall of 2019, at least according to the police report. We do know, by the way, too, something else, and this is a bit interesting. A friend, an alleged friend of his, spoke out and said that he changed during COVID. He became a different person being, and I think he so indicates, more isolated and darker mm-hmm. during COVID.
Gave people a lot of time to spend on the internet. Become radicalized.
You know, and on a mom, I know mom and dad don't live together. But did you see the mural that he painted on mom's house? It's the have a nice day smiley face as the head on a body with holding a sport rifle. So,
and people that listen to his music said his music was always about mass shootings.
So again, you can be dark and you can be some sort of tortured artist, and you can produce imagery or be attracted to imagery that is dark and foreboding and concerning. But the we didn't see anything. There was nothing to see. Well, I mean, that just doesn't hold up to scrutiny based on the evidence we have just in the first few days since this tragic event occurred. Betsy on the North Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, good morning. I have a particular view on this, and I called yesterday about it and couldn't get through, but I completely hold these family members and people that know what's going on as complicit in these crimes. I had to actually call the police yesterday because a friend of mine would not call about her own daughter making very dangerous remarks, hurting herself or others, and on drugs also. And the mother was trying to cover up, got very angry with me when I tried to tell her to please call the police. I ended up calling the police. And, well, I guess that gave her warning, and she got her daughter out of there. The fact that, you know, in other words, you know, in the car and gone, the fact that so many parents, family members, people on the internet know what's going on and do nothing, say nothing, to me, they're just as complicit. I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for the call,
Betsy. A lot of people agree with you. I mean, he had a Smith & Wesson rifle, a Glock handgun, a Caltech rifle, a Remington rifle, and a shotgun.
It's a lot of background checks he passed, which is another part of the
conversation. You know, different times.
Another part of the conversation is how to fold in police reports like the one that Highland Park police filed after they responded to the home in 2019 for consideration by state police. I think there's something you can do about that with respect to, I mean, the FOID card application is a redundancy, the FOID card getting and applying and the background check, it's a redundancy. No matter where you buy a gun in Illinois or the country, you get a background check. Federal firearm licensed dealer has to do the background check 3 day. So that happens. The question is, those background checks are only as good as the thresholds you set and the information contained in databases that the background checkers access. Right.
Right. And Illinois State Police tried to explain that yesterday.
But
we can get to that later if you want to.
But I mean, just on Betsy's point there about, you know, hearing something disturbing, seeing something disturbing. Well, she's on the mark. This happened over the weekend, too. Police in Richmond, Virginia say a plot to attack the city's July 4th celebration was thwarted by a concerned resident. The resident alerted authorities after having overheard a conversation between the two would-be attackers, according to Richmond, Virginia police chief. With the assistance of FBI and Homeland Security, police were able to apprehend two men in possession of two rifles, handgun, and 223 rounds of ammo.
Oof.
Both of the suspects were allegedly in the country illegally. Oh, well, now we implicate another issue, border security. They each have been charged with being a non-citizen in possession of a firearm, with more charges possibly to follow. Unlike in Cook County, the men are also being held without bail as police investigate what they were up to, in addition to being in this country legally and possessing guns illegally. So, but a concerned resident overhearing something.
Did the right thing, came forward, see something, say something, but she did that and saved, I mean, dozens of lives, I'm sure.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about all the new information that has come out on the now confessed Highland Park 4th of July parade shooter who murdered 7 and injured 45 on Monday. Dad talking, family lawyer talking, and all saying the same thing that, as Steve Greenberg, the family attorney, said, no one saw anything because there was nothing to see.
Oof.
You know,
But then he went changed his story. Then he was on ABC Network News and said this.
When the police got there, everyone said the situation wasn't dangerous. It was overblown. The police didn't perceive it to be a dangerous situation.
And the bottom line is the person who called 911, not sure if it was mom or dad, somebody in the house, they decided not to file a complaint. And that's the problem.
You still have the police report. So there was nothing. Nobody saw anything because there was nothing to see. You had police call to the home. You have a police report. You have a police report that was turned over to state police. And then over the years up to present, you have music videos. You have his gaming, more specifically with Call of Duty, that was reported this week. And I'm not saying that anything is causal. I'm saying they're saying nothing to see. And I'm saying there's a lot to see. The sex doll stuff, what was the other thing I mentioned?
He had on Spotify, he had a number of songs that were always talking about
the music videos,
just mass shootings, excuse me.
The music videos. And then
in one of them,
the mural on his mother's home. I mean, come on, there's nothing, nobody saw anything because there was nothing to see. Come on.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And this is not, again, to say legal culpability. This is a conversation mainly about moral culpability. And
Parents need to start parenting. Sorry. And I don't care how old they are. If they're still living with you and they're 22, 21, whatever, you can't just let this slide.
Dad telling the New York Post, I want a long sentence. That's life. You know, you have consequences for actions. He made a choice. He didn't have to do that. I think there's mental illness there, obviously. I didn't see a lot of it. I'm speechless with that. It just took me by such surprise. It's horrible. It's surreal. I mean, I lost a son, too. It sucks. Well, yeah.
Choice of words are interesting.
The part of the question, though, for dad and mom is, when did you lose your son? Yeah, I know formally it was after what he did on Monday. How about informally? What was the relationship like? I mean, these are interesting questions because, again, his public profile, the things he was doing in public, individually, they could raise some question and concern. Collectively, I think they raise a lot. This friend that spoke on a condition of anonymity, he was soft-spoken and polite. If we work late, he always waited for my parents to get me and made sure I got home. His friend, who lives in the same neighborhood as the shooter's dad and uncle, worked with him at Panera Bread until the pandemic forced the place to close. After the shooting broke on Monday, she said her friends checked on her safety and she was going to message Bobby to see, well, the shooter, to see if he was okay. When I saw the police were looking for him, I couldn't believe it. I didn't want to believe it was him. I was hoping it was someone else. The shooter, I knew was never violent. We shared common interests and we worked together and he was never rude to customers. She said they talked about things like life goals, anime, the pandemic, Kobe Bryant's death. I'm still processing it. I've been crying since I saw his face in the news. I haven't eaten or slept since it all happened. My friends told me about the YouTube videos and social media. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't follow him on social media. It's a completely different person than the person I knew. So you factor that in, too. But you know, that's a friend, a work friend, it sounds like, and that's a little bit removed from dad and uncle and mom who have, particularly dad and mom who have, you know, parental responsibilities.
Yeah, and he lost his job in 2019, you know, during the start of the pandemic, 2020.
Right.
And he hasn't worked since.
Pete in Milwaukee on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Say, in all of these terrible situations, I always feel it works out best if at least the shooter was defused, basically shot. But this situation, the police could have gone to this guy's, I'm not protecting him at all, but the police could have gone to this kid's house 15 times. He bought everything legally, and I'm not for gun control either, but he bought everything legally. So unless they just followed this kid around 100% of the time, there was almost no chance of stopping him. This guy was quiet and deranged. The only chance there was is if his parents would have taken away his guns because they knew what was going on. But this is a unique situation because all of the firearms apparently were legal and registered and everything else. That's just what I want to say. It would have been tough to stop this one here.
Thanks for the call, Pete. Yeah, no, I get it. Although this is the conversation about, additional records that law enforcement can access on background checks. And so, something like the police report that Highland Park filed, even though there was no conviction.
Right. It was called a clear and present danger report that they sent to Illinois State Police.
So even though there was no charges, thus no prosecution, no conviction. Maybe that is something that we should consider including in databases that are accessible by individuals doing the background checks for gun purchases. Now, I know what people are going to say. There's concerns about that. What if you have somebody who, made a completely false charge and that police report is still, that police report ends up in a database and now a person is being denied their right illegitimately? Right, I know. This is in the small number of background checks, relatively speaking, that something like this would be at issue. You're going to have human beings make judgment calls. And you also have, you're going to have courts for remedy of any unlawful infringement of people's rights. But, on balance, something like this to be included for police to consider before granting a green light for a gun purchase, maybe that's something that we could come together on and include, just as we've talked about after the Buffalo and Uvalde shootings, the idea of juvenile records being included in the information that background checkers can access when they're making decisions about whether or not to clear somebody to purchase a weapon.
And should they be able to, if you're from, say, Highland Park, and they call the Highland Park Police Department, say, hey, have you ever had any run-ins or encounters with such and such person? Because then they would tell me, yeah, we went there in 2019, attempted suicide, and then, threatening to kill everybody in his family.
Yeah, there's time and there's resources. We have the available resources to do a little legwork on the outlier cases that where there's enough information to say we need to dig a little deeper on this one and let law enforcement, train law enforcement, use their professional judgment.
And
yeah, something there.
Well, do you want to hear what Illinois State Police said about this? I'm trying to make good of this word salad. Here's Brendan Kelly explaining why they allowed him to get a FOID card.
When you go to purchase a firearm, that's one other level of protection that we have in the state in terms of our firearm safety process. It's called FTIP, Firearm Transaction Inquiry Program. And that's a state background check process that is linked with the federal background check process.
Yeah, right.
So redundant. If at the time of this clear and present danger report being submitted, there was insufficient evidence for there to be established a clear and present danger, and nothing different happened to change that outcome between the time of that determination and the time someone went through the multiple background checks, the four or five background checks that this individual did, then that would not be a factor in their background. Because there's no new evidence that would have impacted them. It did not change as a result.
Well, yeah, no kidding, right. Once he clears one background check within his background, then he's going to clear the other ones. No, I get that. The question is, what are the thresholds and what is the information that's accessible and can be included in consideration? That's the conversation we're trying to have. I mean, he's just telling you what the process is. I get the process. And by the way, this idea that's being bandied about maybe the father can be prosecuted for sponsoring him for the Foyt card, that he committed some kind of fraud. Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, here are the eligibility requirements for a Foyt card, reading from the state police website.
Okay.
I've not been convicted of any felony under the laws of this or any other jurisdiction.
Okay.
Check. I've not been adjudicated as a mental defective. Check. I've not been a patient in a mental institution or any part of a medical facility for the treatment of a mental illness within the past 5 years. Check.
Check.
I'm not intellectually or developmentally disabled. Check. I have not within the past year used or been addicted to any controlled substance or narcotics in violation of state or federal law. I don't know about that one.
Yeah.
But you have to prove that the father had some knowledge of this and perjured himself in sponsoring. So, okay, the drug use thing we have to get back to. That's an issue. I am not a subject of existing order of protection or no contact, no stalking order. Check. I've not within the past 5 years been convicted of robbery, assault, blah, blah, blah. Not been convicted of domestic battery. Not been adjudicated by a court as a mental defective. Not a non-citizen unlawfully here. Not within the past year failed a drug test for a drug for which I did not have a prescription. I assume that's a check. We don't know otherwise. Not been admitted to the United States under a non-immigrant visa. Never renounced my citizenship. Never been discharged from the armed services under dishonorable conditions. I'm not a fugitive from justice. I mean, so those are the thresholds you have to clear and that you have to attest to when you apply for your Foyt card and send in your $10 to state police and wait for your Foyt card to come in the mail, you know, a year or two later. Randy and Sandwich, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I want to ask some questions in regards to this avenue because I've been a concealed carry person for 7 years. I've been a Foyt card holder since I was 18. I'm 46 now. And this last round when I had to come in and do my renewal for my concealed carry took 9 months for me to get my approval back in the mail.
Right.
So, of course, everybody's blaming everything on COVID and it's taking time, blah, blah, blah. Well, the people that I frequent with at the gun clubs that I'm at, we're also saying how long the background checks and everything were taking. So if it's taking this long, is it possible that maybe we're short people in this department and things are slipping through the cracks and this is why this kid was able to kind of get through some of these things or not? That's something I think we need to investigate.
Thanks for the call, Randy. Well, first of all, yeah, by statute, it's 90 days, and the state police for a while has not been, generally speaking, abiding that limitation or that time frame. So it's an issue, you know, is it personnel, is it competence, is it some combination of the two? You're talking about state government in Illinois, you know, it's all of the above. But, I mean, there's no evidence that there was anything that slipped through the cracks here. You just heard from state police. Yeah. We just read you the am I eligible requirements to obtain a Foyt card. So if the state police could not access or include the Highland Park police report for consideration as to whether or not to grant him the Foyt card, which they couldn't, then they had to clear him.
We can do better.
Diane in Buffalo Grove.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. I am a lifelong resident of Highland Park. And you'll notice that my fine police, which they are, say, oh, in 2019 there was this, in 2019 there was that. Prior to 2019, I have several neighbors and other community organizations, including a local synagogue, where this individual, there were certainly calls, I don't know the extent of the reports that were written up or kept about this individual. He wasn't merely known for, on the mental health side, saying, hi, I'm homicidal, hi, I'm suicidal in 2019. There were many things before that, okay? So his father, and regarding, again, I hear you, Dan, what could be accessed, homicidal, suicidal in a report, that doesn't, at that age especially, doesn't raise a flag. God help us. God help us is all I can say. We, Amy, as you just said, we can and we must do better.
Thanks for the call, Diane. Yeah. Karen Beecher.
Good morning. Dan, I cannot agree with you more about this being a morality issue, and we got to keep talking about it on that level. I was with my auntie yesterday. I've had my, y'all know from previous stories, I've lost my mom when I was 18. But anyway, so my aunt is really like my mom. She and I talked about this yesterday for about 8 hours, and she keeps saying she knows that my two cousins who are 62 and 64 and her grandkids, these were not red flags to her, those issues that this individual brought up. These were not red flags to her, and there is no way she would have ever turned them in. But to me, I would have had to do something better than what his parents did. And I'm not shaming the parents. I'm not blaming the parents. But there is something we have to do better as parents. It's a dirty, stinking job. And I'm not just talking about changing the diapers. It is a hard job. I've had to think about issues with my own children. I'm not going to go into it, thinking, what does this mean? Where do I have to go? What do I have to do? You as a parent have to do that. And I know without a shadow of a doubt, at the end of the day, I have to answer, not to my kids, not to my husband, not to my auntie, but to a higher power. And if I saw these red flags that everybody else says they didn't see, I would have gone somewhere as an authority, some other type of help, supportive places, and said, help me. I don't know what to do with my kids. There are red flags everywhere. Help me.
Thanks for the call, Karen.
And who knows what they were thinking, why they didn't come forward, why they didn't say, help me.
Yeah.
Did mom think dad was going to do it? Did dad think mom was going to do it? Were they putting it off another day? I mean, what?
I don't know. You think, well, why didn't the parents talk to other parents or to hear from other parents who had concerns? And, sometimes it's this thing like, my kid's got problems. I don't want to talk about it. I'm embarrassed about it. I'm protective of him or her. I get that it's complicated, but I mean, now put yourself in the situation of these parents. Would you rather have, erred on the side of raising these issues and not sort of treating a weapons collection like a stamp collection? No parent wants to be in the situation they're in. No family does. And again, this seems to me there was a lot of things to see that were concerning, and there was a bit of willful blindness going on.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning. morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday we were contacted by a friend of the family of the Highland Park parade shooter who felt like he wanted to set the record straight from his perspective, knowing the family, being in Highland Park, at least having an office in Highland Park. I'm not sure where he lives. We'll find out. He wanted to set the record straight, suggesting that some of the media coverage of the family was unfair and even borderline inappropriate, particularly as it pertains to the interviews of Uncle Paul, the shooter's uncle. And we played a clip of his interview yesterday. So for his perspective, we're pleased to be joined by Stephen Levin. He's a Highland Park. Oh, he is a Highland Park resident, and he also offices in Highland Park, as I understand it, friendly with the family in question in Highland Park. Stephen Levin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Dan and Amy, bittersweet thing on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Calling for you guys.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that you mentioned in the voicemail that you left was about the Uncle Paul, and that it was unfair of the media to put him in the position of responding to what his nephew did. Explain.
When all this went down, in fact, I was driving yesterday and I couldn't get through to the show. I was on hold for about a half hour. And one of the first things that rang out when I heard this story, I literally screamed in bed when I heard the name. When I heard the name Cremo, I said, oh, my God, it has to be his son. It has to be, you know, as this thing was unfolding. And then, you know, I've been following this pretty closely. There's obviously a lot of on the Internet and the news what's going on. And I saw they were interviewing Paulie, Uncle Paulie. I've known Bob and Paulie that own the White Hen and Ravinia on Roger Williams for years and years, a fixture of the community. Paulie is mentally challenged. I mean, sweet, very sweet man. His age is probably 50-ish, but everybody knows that Paulie is mentally challenged.
Okay.
And Bob, the dad, obviously didn't make any statements. He has now made one statement. I saw that.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't believe that the media was interviewing Paulie, yeah, and publicizing that, because anybody that knows Paulie knows that. And Paulie's response was, here, I'm going to be honest, I mean, it was kind of negligent. They saw no signs. I mean, but they're interviewing. I just question the journalistic integrity of interviewing a special needs uncle that lives in the home. I just think it's really unfair. It's unfair to the public. You're not reporting accurately what's going on in that home by asking a special needs uncle. So I thought that was very unfair.
But then you had Dad essentially repeat the position of Uncle Paulie, which is to say, and his lawyer, Steve Greenberg, say there was nothing, nobody saw anything because there was nothing to see. And Dad basically saying, you know, his weapons collection was like me collecting baseball cards or coins. And
I didn't see that statement.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that. I didn't see that.
It's in the New York Post.
Yeah. I'm angry. That's different. There's Paulie's one subject. Interviewing Paulie, I think, is negligent, and I don't think it's fair to the community or to Paul or the whole situation. Interviewing Bob, who I've known Bob many years, I like Bob a ton. I'm very angry, and I hate to say it, I think he's got some culpability possibly here. But Bob was a fixture of the community. Everybody knows Bob. Everybody likes Bob for the most part. He's not like a nut. He's not a right-wing, gun-toting nut. He's a business owner. He ran for mayor. I think he got 28% of the vote. So Bob is not a bad guy. I think right now he's in CYA mode and lawyered up with Greenberg.
Right.
I didn't hear that statement. It's very disturbing. That bothers me too, Dan, that he would talk like that. I think he's very vulnerable legally at this point. So
what about his son? Would his son ever hang out at the White Hen there where his dad and uncle worked? And what about his music?
He would have been a little kid back then. I don't know the kid. I have to be honest. I don't know the kid. I mean, he's 21 years old. I don't know him. But what bothers me is this wasn't a close call. As I've said, if you look in the dictionary under mass shooter, there'd be a picture of his son. He checked every single box. Mm. Every single box. And I think there's There's some negligence and culpability on a lot of people. I mean, the onus is, from what I'm reading with this red flag law, is I'm the closest to the shooter, has the most responsibility to do something, which we can see wasn't done. Is the father, dropped the ball.
Do you have any perspective on mom and dad's relationship? And because she's obviously they're not together. And we also
they're divorced.
Right. And we also see the report out yesterday. We see that the son painted a disturbing mural on the side of mom's house. So mom had to know something, too. I assume she was in his life. But what was that relationship like, to the extent you know?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know mom. I've known Bob for ages. I run into him periodically. I used to see him every day, 2-3 times a day. My office was above the White Hen for many, many years in Highland Park. So I saw Bob all the time. But I maybe met the mom once. I don't know the mom, but I have to absolutely see. He went and borrowed her car after the shooting. This was not a close call. Those parents knew that kid was in grave emotional, mental danger.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a close call. And in hindsight, my heart goes out to everybody, but I feel terrible. I mean, Bob, again, I don't know the mom well at all, but Bob's a good guy. He just, I don't know. I mean, it's so easy to look in hindsight at these parents. What would you do? It's hard to say, but obviously I don't think he did what was needed.
What do you know about his music career and Spotify and how many followers he had on his YouTube channel or any of that?
He had one. He wrote two songs. His rap name was Awake the Rapper, and he wrote two songs that had 1 million streams. Both these songs were about mass shootings. 1 million streams of these songs that were all about mass shootings. He had 16,000 to 20,000 followers on some type of server or some type of social media that he did. But he has a ton of followers, and my goodness, the FBI should certainly take that list of names and start a database on that, because anybody following this kid, this was a very specific thing. He was all about these shootings. I mean, that was his fantasy, was mass shooting and die by police suicide. I mean, he's put that out publicly multiple times, not once. Wasn't a close call. And he also... he also a year ago had made a public statement about shooting in a parade. That was also public. A year ago, he made a statement on social media about wanting to shoot at a parade.
Do you know anything about, did Bob, since you knew him, ever talk about any challenges he thought he had with his son, or whether that his son needed psychiatric care anything about his son that he brought to the attention of people that he knew?
Not me personally. I haven't seen Bob a lot since he had another store that opened in Ravinia, and that closed, I believe, during COVID. I think it shut down a couple years already. So I ran into him about a year ago. It's been a bit. I used to see him all the time. But the only thing I know about that is in 2019, when when they removed 16 knives, a sword, and a dagger from the home, that he did make a statement that he was getting him mental help, that he was getting him help. I hope for Bob's sake he has a huge paper trail of outreaches for help for the kid.
Well, that is interesting. That hasn't been reported that I've seen. And if he did receive psychiatric care, or if he was on psychiatric drugs, I mean, that's something that certainly needs to be included in the conversation. So that would be interesting
It's so hard. I am angry, and I'd love to have a few words with Bob. I mean, I knew him well, and I'd say, what the heck, Bob? What were you thinking? I mean, but I hope for his sake, because, you know, as parents, good people have bad kids. I mean, mental illness has no barriers. It doesn't care who you are.
Right.
The kid was obviously a very sick kid. And I can't believe Bob would be completely negligent and didn't get this kid. I hope that we learn that he tried desperately to get him help, even though I think he fell short of doing what was necessary. I do. I think there's some culpability.
And how do you think after this shooting, how do you think the community that you live in is going to be to treat the family? I mean, this is going to these wounds are never going to heal for a lot of people psychologically.
No, he's going to be an outcast. It's horrible. If I were him, I'd move. I'd be out of there. I don't think he can. How can you? I that's what I'm saying. He really is. I mean, everybody loved Bob. He's a good guy. He was a likable guy. He was a fixture of Virginia. Everybody went through that store. People went out of their way to go to his White Hen because it was the funnest, hippest place, and he made everything from scratch. And his brother Paulie was there helping behind the counter. It was a very hip, a very in spot in Highland Park. And so it breaks my heart that he's just an absolute.
Well,
he's such a
maybe he.
Place.
I mean, he seems to be. He seems to me that he was in some denial about his son. And he may still be in denial now about himself. He said, again, this is from the New York Post, I'm quoting him, of his critics, they make me like I groomed him to do all this. I've been here my whole life, and I'm going to stay here, hold my head up high, because I didn't do anything wrong.
I think he's lawyered up, and I think he's posturing and covering his rear end, because I think he has tremendous exposure and vulnerability. But I know Bob well enough that, I mean, parents, it's so easy for us to say if it was your kid in such trauma. You know, I have a tremendous background history with, there was an AA club upstairs also in above the White Hen there. And I know a lot about addiction and recovery, and, you know, your kids go off the rails. It's really hard to do what's right. Rather, you know, their hearts get in the way. So I feel my heart goes out in that capacity when you have a child basically dying with horrific mental illness. I mean, I can't imagine what that must be like, but I don't think it excuses his responsibility to the community. I think he's, you know, I have some compassion there, but there's plenty of anger also that he allowed something so dangerous to. I mean, it's one thing to have a kid out of control. It's another thing to have a kid out of control saying and doing what he's professing and having dangerous weapons available. I mean, you just can't, you know, it wasn't like he was drinking and getting DUIs. There was just so many mass shooting references. You just have to, as a prudent citizen, even with the child, that's where some of my anger comes in, like I said, but there's some compassion there. I mean, we're human. I mean, this kid was just sick. Sick as can be, and I can't imagine what it'd be like having that kid. And I think right now he's in CYA mode. I mean, can you imagine what he's feeling like? The whole community's going to come down on him like a ton of bricks. just sad.
He is.
Nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. He is Stephen Levin.
So I just want to.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to put a little compassion out there. I mean, he's not a bad guy.
Okay.
Bob Cremo's not a bad man. He was a business owner of the community. He ran for mayor to fight for, you know, my other dear friend that owns the store that the shooter was on top of. You know, these were just business owners trying to survive during all this. You know, they're just trying to feed their families. Bob was a good, hardworking guy and gave a lot to the community. And this is just awful what's happened to everybody in the community. And my heart somewhat goes out for him also. I mean, nobody asked it. You have a child born like this. I can't imagine how horrific, but I think he absolutely has some vulnerability and culpability on just not taking the right measures with this situation.
All right, well, we just
devastated.
We appreciate your perspective and a little bit more context as somebody who knows the father. He's Stephen Levin. He's a Highland Park resident and also a businessman in Highland Park. Again, friend of the father of the Highland Park parade shooter. Stephen Levin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy. Have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is how the deep state works. The deep state had long been accustomed to public deference to its dominance of state and society. Eventually, however, it faced a genuine challenge from an unconventional politician, animated largely by profound dissatisfaction with the status quo that, after simmering for decades, finally erupted into view, first among more traditional non-elite elements. At the tip of the spear was media, dominated by corrupt corporate oligarchs who entrenched their position by cultivating and maintaining close relationships with the state. It was staffed by a journalistic elite deeply indoctrinated in the official ideology of the deep state, submissive to the permanent bureaucracy. Military leaders claiming to represent the most revered institution in the country appropriated the public's respect for serving soldiers as an endorsement of the leadership's political interests and post-retirement perks. Prominent members of the elite managerial and professional class ensconced in their stylish metropolitan bubbles and generally clueless about the wider society, called on the military to save the establishment, which they equated with democracy itself. Mass demonstrations were organized, castigating the traditional religious values important to the challenger's voters as inherently theocratic and unacceptable. The political leader was subjected to an investigation and prosecution, hounded from office, and banned from the public square. Anti-establishment activists and critics, political moderates who simply questioned the wisdom of the established order, pious citizens, and others were threatened with exposure as closet reactionaries, shunned and purged from public life. Those are the words of Nicholas Cass in a piece in the American Conservative. And he's not talking about Trump. He's not talking about America's deep state and Trump. But boy, doesn't it sound like a description of what we've experienced over the last, going on 6 years. For more on the lessons we can learn from the experience of the deep state in another country, pleased to be joined by Nicholas Spiridon Cass. He served with the U.S. government for 31 years. He retired on January of this year, and of 2021, excuse me. Most recently, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Director for European Affairs, and Director of Intelligence Programs at the White House and National Security Council, and Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Europe at the National Intelligence Council. And his most important credential, which I'm sure he loves to hear, is that he's the brother of one friend of the show, John Cass.
Oh, yes.
JohnCassNews.com. I assume, Nicholas, you have a subscription.
Yes, I do.
Very, very good.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi, Amy. Dan. Again, it's a great honor to be on your show.
Oh, great to have you.
Thank you. If I may, I think that, I've been a fan for a long time, and I really just want to say that what you do, what your show does, is very, very important. It's not only a great thing to listen to when you're driving into work, but you provide a forum for real thoughtful and practical conservative approaches to governance. And that is really, really necessary, more necessary than any time I can imagine, and certainly in my adult life. It's hard to do that in Illinois in particular. But I know you have some friends and supporters and people who, really admire you as well. And I'm one of them. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Please cut and print that. Yeah. Put that on a continuous loop for the show.
And Amy 24-7.
24, exactly.
You can't have it.
And why doesn't John ever say nice things to us like that?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe
we were having the wrong brother on the show.
Wait, do you like cats?
Yeah. No, here, John Cass
no,
does
not
John, like
cats. Do you like cats, Nicholas?
He does not like the cat.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Do you like cats?
I'm more of a dog guy myself. Okay. I'm actually staying with a friend who's got a couple of cats, but I've asked them to quarantine them so I can breathe.
There you go. Oh. It runs in the family. I got it.
Okay. Exactly.
It's an ongoing joke I have with your brother.
All right. So let's talk. This piece that you wrote and that your brother directed my attention to is so interesting. I love the description, which I just excerpted from. Tell us what I was describing, because it's not Trump.
Well, it's really interesting. We just passed the 25th anniversary of a seminal event in modern Turkish history, which was the coup d'etat of February 28th that began on February 28th, 1997. It's called the February 28th process. And basically, it was an effort by the aggressively and ideologically rigid and authoritarianly secularist Kemalist regime in Turkey to destroy all challengers and comers, and particularly the challenge posed by Necmettin Erbakan, back in 1997 and his Islam-rooted Refah party. And so this secularist elite went into overdrive, working with, as we call it, the deep state, to try to topple this guy and bring him down and to, you know, make sure that he never raised his head again. And it's really interesting because when we talk about deep state in the aftermath of President Trump's emergence as a candidate in 2016, and then, you know, the past 6 years, as you pointed out, we do hear people talk about the deep state in the United States now, and the concept itself comes from Turkey, from some of the experiences like this coup in 1997 and other coups. And so it occurred to me, having spent a lot of time in Turkey, knowing something about the culture and the place, that there might be lessons that could be learned from looking at the Turkish experience, how they dealt with the deep state, what the implications of this 1997 coup were for the future of Turkish political stability as the history unfolded over the next few years. We are also looking at the coming up on the sixth anniversary of the most recent coup attempt in Turkey, a failed military coup that killed about 200 people, 250 people, and wounded about 2,200. It failed and led to a scorched earth crackdown by the government, by the Erdogan government, which survived the coup, and you know, again, had learned its lessons very, very well from the 1997 experience. And that experience basically taught them, I think, that the establishment was never going to allow them a decent shake. And so when the establishment and others tried to topple him violently in 2016, the response was pretty predictable and understandable in the context of Turkish politics.
Yeah. What was the media's involvement in the 1997 Turkish coup?
Well, the media was controlled by a number of oligarchs who were using their media operations to leverage favors from the state. And so and they would reciprocate by helping the state. And the media, therefore, basically tried to help drive this story of Necmet and Erbakan and the Refah Party as insurrectionist, as science deniers. That was one of my favorite ones. I remember that. Deniers of science, deniers of reason. And, you know, otherwise just being backward religious folks who, you know, had no legitimacy. And it was really, really dangerous at the time. And I knew at the time that it was going to what was being sown then was going to be reaped later. And that's exactly what happened. So the media played a very, very important role in driving public fears and expectations and concerns about what was going to happen next. You know, we've seen some extraordinary parallels to the United States. It's hard to deny them. I mean, I think it's kind of indisputable that that many of the key characteristics of American governance and political the political atmosphere are very, very much on of the same of a kind with those particular Turkish experiences from 1997 and subsequently. So.
But as you
write this,
as you write in your piece, though, of course, America is not Turkey, at least not yet.
Right.
So the parallels are striking. What are the takeaways for us? You know, what should we learn from what happened there and sort of, you know, right size to apply to America?
Well, the bottom line, I mean, if you think about what happened after the 1997 coup, Turkey was ruled then by you know, some extremely incompetent secularist governments that basically kowtowed to the establishment view. The last one before the rise of the AKP was actually led by a man who had been a politician for many, many years and was clearly in failing health. He was very, very old. He could barely move around. I mean, again, another striking parallel there, if you want to put it that way. These guys came back as one would have expected. They reconstituted a new party with a new leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was an associate of Erbakan back during the coup. He was the mayor of Istanbul and had been kicked out of office and jailed for as part of that crackdown. And his party in 2002 came back to power, and instead of trying to accommodate the reality, the deeply rooted reality of the AKP's constituency and actual existence, the deep state in Turkey doubled down and immediately, you know, began its existential quest to get rid of these guys again. And the consequences were very, very severe because Erdogan kept on winning. The AKP government kept on winning, despite the efforts by the Kemalists to overthrow this government again. There was an incident in 2007 when the military issued another warning. In 2008, the so-called judicial coup, when they tried to orchestrate a constitutional court case to ban the AKP, that was defeated only when people realized that there would have been chaos if they had succeeded. And then, of course, in 2016, another coup d'etat attempt that led to the, you know, reaction by Erdogan and his associates to root out these guys once and for all. And of course, it's not just the Kemalists. There was a group of people called the followers of Fethullah Gulen, who is often he's a U.S. Person. He's often lionized in the press as a supporter of democracy, but of course was a led an organization that was a very hard-headed and a power-driven organization of its own. He was a provisional ally with the AKP, but they broke relations in about 2013. In 2016, he was seen as a major factor, if not the factor, behind this military coup. But so his followers were one target, and the other target was the Kemalists. And, you know, the resulting human cry from the West was extreme. But again, you have to think about how, in actual fact, in a society like Turkey, how people learned about politics and what they were confronted with politics meant. And politics was clearly a full contact game. I mean, saying politics ain't beanbag doesn't even go close to describing what the situation is.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, but so then, I mean, how do you translate that to making a threat assessment in America of sort of our version of the Kemalists, the deep state, the roll up of both powerful public sector agencies, intel, law enforcement, with all of the cultural and business and civic institutional leaders. How do you tailor what you're describing in Turkey to what you're seeing in America and what the response should be?
Well, it's a very interesting question. What we've seen, I think what we're confronting with is a situation where people, where the underpinnings of traditional American idea of governance have been so assaulted. You know, we don't even teach civics anymore. Kids don't even understand what the Constitution is about. Right. They don't understand what separation of powers means. And that's kind of evident when you look at some of the argumentation against the recent Supreme Court rulings. I mean, people, it's extraordinary ignorance, right?
Yeah.
And so in a situation like that, where people have been on board, the only thing that matters is power. And what you're seeing, I think, certainly since the investigation started against President Trump, the completely false accusations, the President of the United States was a Russian agent, okay? all of that through the impeachments and now through the January 6th, so-called January 6th commission, which is completely one-sided and farcical. I mean, again, I'm perhaps being a little bit more polemical than I wanted to be coming on the show, and certainly didn't want to do that in writing, because I'm trying to appeal to liberals, people who, you know, liberals, and say, look, guys, what do you think is going to be the consequence of what it is that's being done here? How do you think the next generation is going to respond? And I think what you're seeing already on the conservative side is the sense that this is like frontier warfare, that the tomahawks are out, and that there's no returning to the status quo ante. It's fight or you know, be driven out. And that suggests that we're going to see some really, really turbulent times ahead. I don't think the Kemalists in America will learn the lesson about the spanking that they're going to get, probably what looks like to be the electoral spanking that they're going to be faced in 2022. I suspect that they will double down. Their impulse will be to double down. There may be some wiser heads who can calm folks down, but I suspect that they will continue pushing their most radical agenda that they can. And, of course, that's going to breed a reaction depending on how hard they push. I mean, if we're talking about – if liberals and the progressive left talks about democracy and saving democracy, then they have to understand that they will be at least as responsible, at least as responsible for any departure from quote-unquote democratic norms or democracy than the people who they demonized. And this is not a good place to be for our country. But I suspect, you know, again, if you're looking at it from outside, you're looking at this as the beginning of a long, long and very, very turbulent moment in American politics, and people are from outside are going to be watching and drawing conclusions from that.
He is Nicholas Cass. He served the federal government for 31 years, served in the federal government, retiring just last year. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Director for European Affairs, Director of Intel Programs at the White House and National Security Council, and Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Europe at the National Intelligence Council. And do check out his piece, Lessons from a Turkish Coup, at theamericanconservative.com, which I will tweet out at Dan Proft. Nicholas Cass, thanks so much for joining us. Pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good piece from Frank Mealy in RealClearPolitics.com. The Dobbs ruling, a victory for black life. It's been well known for decades that Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers have a disproportionate presence in black and other minority neighborhoods. You can argue whether that's because of racist intentions, but you can't argue with the numbers. In 2019, twice as many legal abortions were performed on minority women as on white women. In total, 33% of abortions obtained by white women, 38% by black women, 21% by Hispanic women. Only 7% of abortions performed on women of Asian, Native American, or other extraction. It's estimated that more than 63 million babies were aborted since Roe in 73. More than 20 million, nearly a third of those, were black babies. You want to talk about robbing the black community of untold human potential. The black voice in American life was diminished, and yet privileged white liberals celebrate abortion, and they particularly celebrate it in black communities. One wonders, doesn't one? Particularly when you have radical left pro-abortion Pauls like Krakajewia there in Massachusetts, who now are targeting crisis pregnancy centers.
Is she out of her mind?
She's targeting them rhetorically and potentially legislatively, while her goon squads, Ruth Sentas and others, are firebombing churches and vandalizing crisis pregnancy centers and the like. Oh, and by the way, why, as we talked to Kevin Brock yesterday, former assistant director of counterterrorism at FBI, why you can't get local law enforcement to protect the homes of Supreme Court justices who were part of the majority in the Dobbs case, despite an assassination plot against Brett Kavanaugh.
But the media just kind of mentioned vaguely and moved on.
And I'm sorry, tell me again who are the extremists? Tell me again who are the
radicalized group?
Maybe? Well, I want to call them children, but they're so much more dangerous because they're given to violence in pursuit of their position. So, you know, temper tantrums are mildly annoying and somewhat entertaining. Firebombings, vandalism, assassination plots,
yeah,
that's not kids' stuff anymore, is it? No. Pun intended.
And they're proud of it, and they said they're not going to stop.
Listen to Elizabeth Warren.
Also taking aim at pregnancy crisis centers.
Here in Massachusetts, these so-called crisis pregnancy centers outnumber genuine abortion clinics by 3-1.
She says women walk into the centers believing they'll get abortions. Instead, they try to talk women out of it. She calls it a bait and switch.
They are giving it over to people who wish them harm. And that has to stop. We need to put a stop to that in Massachusetts right now.
A stop to what? To saying we'd like to help you have your child if that's what you want to do. And, oh, by the way, we have these services and we can access these resources for you. She's alarmed that crisis pregnancy centers outnumber abortion mills in Massachusetts by 3-1. But this is just about being pro-choice, not about being pro-abortion. Is this a competition? Do you want more abortions? Abortion is a happy occurrence? People don't believe that. Elizabeth Warren does. Sacrament of the religious cult that is leftism in America. That's what you're hearing. I mean, just work the logic of what you just heard in that report and from Elizabeth Warren. Crisis pregnancy centers providing aid and comfort to pregnant women who are in crisis, thus the term for crisis. The center. And if for this fear, crisis, lack of resources, pressure from a boyfriend or husband, whatever it is, but for that, you would want your child and you would have your child, and we're here to help. That's a threat. It is to Elizabeth Warren. It's bizarre, isn't it? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Amy Gerke. She's the executive director of Illinois Right to Life. Amy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What about Elizabeth Warren's concern that we need to right-size the balance of abortion mills and crisis pregnancy centers? Can't have CPCs outnumbering abortion mills.
Oh, well, definitely not. Actually, I think you hit the nail on the head when you asked, is this a competition? And I really believe for the abortion industry and their sycophants in the legislatures across the country, like Elizabeth Warren and our own J.B. Pritzker, it is a competition. Pregnancy resource centers take away revenue directly from the abortion industry. And, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years, and whenever you look at anything that is outrageous to the abortion industry, it always comes down to money. And right now, pregnancy resource centers, who, as you know, are staffed by people who, you know, give of their lives and of themselves to help women. They're the most selfless people you'll ever meet. To say that they're a threat and that they're out to bait and switch women is, I mean, shows how much the pro-abortion left has lost its collective mind.
So what are the rules going to be here in Illinois when we become the abortion oasis, as, you know, Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker called it? It's going to be up until the day before they birth? Or are we talking infanticide? What are the rules?
Well, you know, we've seen Governor Pritzker double down on his abortion advocacy ever since the leak of the draft opinion back on May 1st. And the thing that we're really afraid of at Illinois Right to Life is that abortion advocates are going to go after the pregnancy resource centers here in the state. There are pregnancy resource centers here outnumber abortion clinics significantly. There are, I believe it's 95 pregnancy resource centers in the state of Illinois. And, you know, we fully expect abortion advocates led by Personal PAC and Planned Parenthood with the help of Governor Pritzker to go after the pregnancy resource centers. We saw legislation last session to try and control the speech and the promotion that PRCs were able to do, and that thankfully didn't go anywhere, but we would not be surprised at all to see legislation that is directed at curtailing what pregnancy resource centers are able to do, how they're able to operate, et cetera.
Yeah, I got to go back to something implicit in what Elizabeth Warren was saying, too, which is that women don't have agency. This is what the left does. It infantilizes people, infantilizes yeah. anybody that they that's part of their coalition, at least these ruling class types. So a woman walks into a pregnancy resource center. I still call them crisis pregnancy centers, but pregnancy resource center. I know that's the proper terminology these days. And says, well, we have these resources. We can provide this support if you want to reconsider what you're, or if you want to consider life rather than, and the woman is persuaded and then makes a decision. So the woman only has agency when she makes the decision to have an abortion, not when she makes the decision to have the child. It's so infantilizing, and it should be insulting to women.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's the thing that I just can't believe so many women don't see is that, you know, the feminist movement has told us that we're strong enough and brave enough to do anything, you know, to succeed in our careers and to do anything a man can do until we're pregnant. And then, oh no, you're too weak. You're too, you know, scared that you can't do this. It absolutely degrades women. And abortion really is one of the most anti-woman misogynistic industries out there. It makes me outraged just about more than anything about this industry. And the fact that they're saying that these centers are baiting and switching women. I have heard so many stories of women who've gone to Planned Parenthood clinics. Actually, Pastor Chris Butler, a friend of both of ours, he and his wife, when they were pregnant with their first child, went to a Planned Parenthood for an ultrasound, and they desperately wanted this baby. Despite that fact, the clinic tried to coerce them into aborting the child. So, you know, it's not the pregnancy resource centers that are trying to persuade women to do something that they don't want. The abortion industry is all about abortion and selling abortions and encouraging women to do away with their children.
I've heard my whole life, you know, Planned Parenthood does more than just abortions. I mean, are they going to be able to survive in states that are red?
Well, we hope not. Anyway, I think I saw the most recent number I saw is something along the lines of 49 abortion clinics have closed since the Dobbs decision came down, which is amazing, amazing news. There are also stories of men having vasectomies, women reconsidering their promiscuous lifestyles, et cetera. So, you know, Dobbs was already having a positive effect, encouraging people to take personal responsibility. So, you know, the good of this decision, you know, what are we, a week and a half out from it now, is already being seen.
So there's a rally coming up this weekend. We wanted to make sure we got to. It's good in the face of the ugliness of the pro-abort radicals that have taken to the streets and engaged in all kinds of violence, and we see pro-lifers in Chicagoland ready to stand up and make their voices heard. So tell us about this rally coming up on Saturday.
Well, we hope everybody will join us. March for Life Chicago is hosting the rally. Illinois Right to Life is a proud supporter of this event. It will be this Saturday, July 9th at 2 p.m. in Federal Plaza. We have a number of speakers, people from pregnancy resource centers, local leaders, local pro-life leaders. And basically, our goal is to celebrate this decision, celebrate the fact that states can now protect preborn babies, and also to stand up to the abortion radicalism that Governor Pritzker and Mayor Lightfoot are putting forth. Illinois is, at its heart, I believe, a pro-life state. We've been co-opted by abortion radicals, and we're going to stand in Federal Plaza, celebrate this decision, and let Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker know that Illinois will not stand for their abortion extremism.
All right. Very good. She's Amy Gerke. She's the executive director of Illinois Right to Life. The rally, as she was just mentioning, in March. Saturday, 2 p.m., Federal Plaza, 50 West Adams in Chicago. So come out and stand for life and for those pregnancy resource centers that have Elizabeth Warren all upset. Amy, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
So you caught up with your old pal Triple Threat yesterday. Find out more about this toxicity in our civil discourse, in our political discourse, which we need to address, and whether or not she's been contributing to the positive or negative.
Well, yeah, because, you know, she has made some disparaging remarks, like,
oh, really?
You know, F you Trump and F Clarence Thomas. So I started asking the question, and she just got a little,
This is a follow-up from yesterday, because a lot of people took offense, and I don't know if you saw it on the national media, about your comment about toxicity in our public discourse. So when you say
I have to laugh at that. Okay. Who questions one bit that our national civic conversation is anything other than toxic? The fact that people can put something benign on social media and just get eaten by bots and by nasty, horrible people, daily evidence, multiple times daily evidence of how toxic our civic debate unfortunately has become.
F you, Jacobson.
So my question is, when you said F you to Trump and F Clarence Thomas, people thought that you were adding to the toxicity in our public discourse. So, what, you know, did you think that that using
no,
that was
I stand by my comments about
toxic.
Recall,
no.
President Trump, at the time that I made my remark, said that protesters, peaceful protesters exercising their First Amendment rights should be shot. Think about how awful that is coming from the supposed leader of the free world. And Clarence Thomas is a hypocrite who should never have been confirmed. And the fact that he is using his platform on the Supreme Court to blithely act like he can just erase our rights with the stroke of a pen, I stand by my comments.
And I was like, what they took the microphone away from me. How is Clarence Thomas a hypocrite?
Well, first of all, how is he doing it by himself? The Dobbs decision was 6-3.
Exactly. And that was one man's opinion.
Yeah, I mean,
and he put in marriage equality and contraception.
Well, whatever.
And the other ones,
whatever.
Didn't.
Yeah. A counselor. this is. You're not familiar with how the Supreme Court works. You're not familiar with the three branches of government. Here, let me explain it to you. Maybe you'll get a little less persnickety and profane if you understand how this actually works. Trump said this, and Clarence Thomas is doing that. All demagoguery. From, you know, a little wannabe potentate. Toxicity. She is a walking embodiment of everything that's toxic in this city and in our discourse.
And has she read her own tweets? I mean, she's talking about nastiness on Twitter. You are nasty sometimes.
Do you think, next time, does, you know, Clarence Thomas, given that the threat that he poses, unilaterally, single-handedly taking away your rights, what do you think? Should he even be entitled to a law enforcement protection?
Trying to ask her, but this is how you're saying F. Clarence Thomas while there's an actual assassination plot against Justice Kavanaugh.
So what about that? What about the violence directed at pregnancy resource centers and the vandalism of churches and the assassination plot against Kavanaugh? Is that the sort of thing where you think the toxicity of our discourse is a contributing factor? Is that the sort of thing where you think that maybe when a politician is leading a rally from a concert stage of F. Clarence Thomas, that somebody marginally connected to reality with violent tendencies may take that cue, do you think? Is that sort of the example, the sort of thing that you're talking about? A la the congressional softball practice shooting and so many other instances, not holding anybody responsible other than those people who committed the acts of violence. But when her argument is about contributing factors and one of them being the toxicity of our discourse in terms of leading to not seeing the humanity in other people. Do you see the humanity in Clarence Thomas? Do you see the humanity in Donald Trump? Do you see the humanity in anybody, frankly, who disagrees with you? You sad little mayor. Sad little mayor. Just another in a long line of sad little mayors in Chicago. Chicago, which is ground zero for toxicity when it comes to discourse and just about everything else.
And it's so bad, even the Bears moved out under her watch.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. the teachers unions, the National Education Association's annual conference is underway in our fair city of Chicago.
Please tell me they're all masked up and wearing gloves.
Well, they are calling for a national policy of mandatory masking, mandatory vaccinations, as well as rejecting the words mother and father. These are really core principles when it comes to providing educational opportunity to, at the K through 12 level, clearly. one of the new business initiatives at the conference.
Do I want to know this or is it going to make me nauseous?
No, I'm just quoting here just to provide a little bit more texture. A national policy of mandatory masking and COVID vaccines in schools, as well as high quality virtual education for immunocompromised students and all families who want it. This really requires national policy making. Another proposal, publicizing the NEA will publicize its commitment to young people's right to learn about, develop their own sexual orientation and gender identity. To develop their own sexual orientation and gender identity. It's an interesting choice of words.
Instead of persuading it?
Okay. LGBTQIA plus inclusive, birthing parent and non-birthing parent, no mom and dad. NEA is a social justice union that is a majority female and trans and gender non-confirming folks.
And the pronouns they use?
Calling to, publicly stand for abortion and calling abortion limits an attack on students, families, and communities. Right. There's nothing like policies that eliminate family members that are characterized as attacks on family. That's the NEA in Chicago. So that's the bad news, but you expect that from the red shirts from CTU and the other Marxists in education. The good news is what's actually happening at the local level in some surprising places. For example,
is this the good news part?
This is the good news part. The San Francisco School Board. The San Francisco School Board. You know, where you had a few school board members recalled not so long ago, returned the admissions policy at Lowell, the city's most prestigious public high school, to the merit-based system it had used for more than a century, ending a short-lived lottery introduced in the name of racial equity.
Oh.
Yeah. You get in based on your academic record and test scores, like, you know, how we used to do it in the olden days, 5 minutes ago. The board also abandoned a campaign to erase the life of Washington, which was a WPA-era mural at George Washington High School that became a cause celeb for both sides by a communist artist, of course. Are there any other kind? The earlier incarnation of the board had first voted to destroy it, then to cover it up, saying it was a form of reparations to remove it from public view. 2-4-3 votes. So it's close, but I mean, 4-3 votes in favor of merit and American history in San Francisco. That's pretty encouraging.
Yeah.
How about this student revolt in Washington Heights in Manhattan? Paula Lev is a principal for the High School for Law and Public Service. Name of the school. Facing a Department of Education probe last year after telling a teacher she was, quote, going to get rid of all these white teachers that aren't doing anything for the kids of our community, unquote. She gave notices to white staffers, a number of white staffers at the 450 student school, made other unpopular changes. And the rejection of what she was doing, the racial identity politics, came from the students. How encouraging is this? Angel Delawar, 17 years old, senior in September, is the class valedictorian, started a petition on change.org saying, "We've had enough and cannot bear to witness the utter disorganization and insanity at our school. We have some new teachers that are super underqualified and staff members that were fully experienced and qualified were accessed," meaning sidelined. And so he started, I think it's a he, yeah, started the petition last year. He also mentioned, right now students can do anything they want. They're not going to get in trouble. Oh, we've seen that. Places like Oak Park, River Forest High School here.
Yeah.
It's just, boy, a school board in San Francisco responding to what the public's reaction was to previous decisions by the school board. There's a little discipline being instituted at the local level there. And then students at that high school in Washington Heights. And those are some encouraging notes. We're getting to perhaps critical mass where people are tired of letting these identitarian goons run roughshod over them and all good sense when it comes to important things like kids' education. For more on this and other matters, please be joined by Noah Rothman, Associate Editor for Commentary Magazine. His new book, The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives' War on Fun. Noah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So how about these? You know, they're little green shoots. The NEA is still dominant, but encouraging, particularly in some of the places where the encouragement is coming from.
Yes, there absolutely is a counter-revolution underway, and it is very heartening, and it's derived from the fact that these institutions have decided to do a lot of things they don't know how to do and don't do them well. The NEA is a very perfect example. National Education Association has one job, that is to represent educators in labor negotiations. That's it. But it has decided its job is to involve all those expansive issues about racial dynamics in America and housing policy. And they had a resolution condemning Russia. Your job is not to get into foreign policy. Stay in your lane. This is part of the problem with why institutions are sapping credibility and American trust. They've decided they have to be everything to everyone. They don't do the thing they're designed to do well anymore. They're terrible at doing everything. And so people lose faith and trust in it, just as the effort, you know, the sort of 2020-led hysteria that created this idea that we have to pursue equity over equality. Governments and public institutions don't know how to eliminate racism. They know how to educate students. They know how to pick up trash. They know how to police streets. But they don't know how to end poverty, end racism, end human frailty. And yet they've committed themselves to these courses, and it's not working for them. It's failing on their own merits. So, of course, there's a backlash from people who actually want these institutions to perform their designated roles. Specialization is a good thing. We should keep it.
You know, I think the NEA should apply for independent membership in NATO, since they have so much to say about, the security in the West. What do you think?
They might get observer status, I believe.
You've got this new book. This is, I think we're getting to a good place, too, because I've seen a couple of books sort of this, taking this angle. The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives, War on Fun. The misery-inducing nature of those who want to politicize all aspects of life. You have an anecdote in an excerpt I read from your new book about a wedding you attended that I think illustrates this. But I think we're getting to a good place where it's not even being taken serious. It's an object of ridicule. That's probably a good place culturally.
That's what I hope to at least create a permission structure around. I'm talking about the puritanically inclined progressive. It's the small group of individuals that punch way above their weight.
Yeah.
So for all of our adult lives, it was the right that could be counted on to moralize, to preen, to see an innocent cultural affair, the sort of stuff that degrades society and corrupts you. And the left, the liberals, emphasized self-status, self-gratification, self-fulfillment as its own value, even to the point of being self-destructive. We are privy now, all of a sudden, to moral crusades led by the left, and it is sapping apolitical aspects of life of their apolitical nature, and it's thus sapping them of joy. Comedians emphasizing the pain that you have to somebody experience so you could enjoy a punchline. Sports programs that involve prolonged digressions into the lamentable state of American racial dynamics, and when fans protest, they are explicitly admonished for putting their need for escapism over their duty to dwell on the pain of existence in perpetuity. This is puritanical in nature. Progressives probably don't recognize that in themselves, but that's vanity. As progressives have identified less with liberalism, they've come to identify, to adopt progressivism's habits of mind, which involve a fear of idleness, hatred of idleness. Anything that doesn't serve a utilitarian purpose is ultimately the instrument of wickedness, a utopianism, and a fear of pastimes and what those pastimes can do to an individual who is not dedicated to the promotion of the progressive project at all times. And it is total. This is not a private practice. You're being drafted into it. So what I hope to do is popularize this case against a new priggish moral order that is coming to the fore led by the left, some of which is time-tested and true, and conservatives know it to be time-tested and true because it is a conservative social theory of social organization. It's just not native to the left that used to be very hedonistic and libertine and is no longer.
Well, and you had we talked to Eddie Scari from The Federalist yesterday, and he told a story about sitting with a friend of his who's a liberal. And they were talking about the Rittenhouse verdict, and the bartender attempted to intervene in their conversation because, you know, she had clearly had a position different than Eddie's and similar to his friends and so on and so forth. And Eddie just said, well, you know, we're talking amongst ourselves here. You weren't invited.
She wanted to say how it was racist.
Yeah, you weren't invited into the conversation, and you sort of had a moment like that too. That I think a lot of people have experienced because you hear so many anecdotes. That's illustrative of the moral priggishness you're talking about at this wedding I mentioned.
I'm not sure. I'm familiar with this wedding story that you're referring to.
Oh, wait.
I think that is in scary. That is in Eddie's book.
I'm conflating the two. Sorry. Okay.
Not a problem because that is good. That suggests it's in the water. This theme is in the ethos or the ether, and I'm trying to drive it out. I saw Eddie's interview. He's identifying something that is obviously a hard to avoid scenario. And I was on Morning Joe this morning promoting this book, and there's furious passion in the effort to try to contend. No. Republicans are still the prudes, still the priggish. We're nice and libertine and light.
There's so much evidence to the contrary. You were on Morning Joe this morning promoting this book. How did they tell us how that went with Joe and Mika?
Well, they're very generous with their time.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of pushback, I'll say, and we're all friends over there. So there's a little bit of pushback, but pushback is good. You don't get flack unless you're over the target.
Yeah, right.
What did they push back on you for?
Oh, the idea that progressives are a leading moral crusade and that the right has somehow fallen behind or they've been eclipsed by the left. Now, if I was writing a book about the old Puritans, I would say, yes, Republicans have cultural revanchist strains. They have social conservative theories of social organization, and they're very mad at the fact that they don't get enough attention from their representatives about it. Talk to any of them. They'll tell you freely. But I saw Eddie's an interview with Tucker Carlson about this book, and he made the point that you can observe these trends, but I'm not exactly sure where they come from. I am. This book tells you where they come from. This book establishes the thread, pulling the thread of intellectual history from the 1600s through the 1900s through today. It breaks down this ideological tendency and the habits of mind that accompany it and explains to you why they're doing this and how to diffuse it.
Hmm. Okay, well, that's a value add. I like that. That's a good angle into this larger conversation. Noah Rothman is associate editor for Commentary Magazine. The book, his new book that we've been discussing, The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives' War on Fun. Noah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I think our friend Willie Wilson has sparked a trend. And now this is not free gas. And he's doing another gas giveaway this weekend.
Yeah, and he's also been doing grocery giveaways, too. So.
And he's put $5 million in his mayoral campaign, so he's up on our airwaves and on TV, too. Interesting.
Good for him.
I wouldn't rule Willie out in a crowded field. I wouldn't rule him out. It's interesting what he's doing. Well, here's what Americans for Prosperity did at a gas station, and our friend Brad Palumbo rode point as the man on the street doing some interviews. The gas prices were lowered to $2.38 a gallon.
I'd crawl there.
Well, here's what some people had to say to Brad.
What does it mean to you to be able to get affordable gas again?
When I heard about it, I said, oh Lord, let me get there. So I'm very grateful, you know, because they didn't have to do this. Mm-hmm. Gas is so high.
high. Everything is high, and I'm on a fixed income. Okay.
Will that make a big difference in your life, just financially?
Yes. I can buy some food.
I'm tired right now, so this is really great for me because you run across a hard time.
Just gas because you know gas prices have gone up in the recent times. With DoorDash and whatnot, you know, it pays a lot.
Oh, it's a blessing. Yeah. It really is. Really,
I love it. Honestly, I feel like gas is just so expensive right now, and my car is burning through gas because we're always like out and about, me and my kids. So when my mom told me about it, I live like right here, really close. So I was like, yeah, I hopped on it. I came here at 9:30, and I'm super happy because I know, I mean, hopefully we can get cheap gas again.
Yeah, so you get the gist. And by the way, a recent Monmouth poll in terms of the issue matrix. What is the biggest concern for Americans? Number one by a wide margin, and really one and two because they're connected. Biggest concern, Monmouth poll.
Can I guess? No.
It will go ahead.
No, because you know I'll guess wrong.
Well, you
is
may.
Is it abortion?
You're going to lose that $100 bet.
What, gun control?
33% say inflation.
Okay.
15% say gas prices. That's nearly half the country saying essentially gas, inflated gas prices are, and groceries, the biggest issue. 9% economy. So there's not, now you're up to 47%. Right. 6% bills and groceries. Now you're up to, what is, what did I say? 56%. Now you're at a supermajority. You're at 60% roughly. Then abortion at 5%, guns 3%, healthcare 3%, unemployment, on down the line. 33, 15, 9, 6, 48, 57, 63% of Americans. Inflation, gas prices, economy, bills, and groceries. They're all saying, you know, right, versions of the same thing. That's where it's at. For more on this, pleased to be joined by the man who did the interviewing, Brad Palumbo, policy correspondent for Foundation for Economic Education, contributor to the Washington Examen, co-founder of Based Politics as well. Brad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. And I'm very impressed with your addition skills. I was trying to work that out in my head and struggling.
Thank you so much. A high school graduate you're talking to here. So don't mean to brag. It's interesting because you know what the response is going to be, but I wonder, you know, people who really are saying, obviously everybody would like to pay less for everything, but it's paying less for it, and it's like, oh, this is nice, and it's paying less for it like this is helping me survive today and this week.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. You guys played a clip there, and I ended up putting out like 5 to 7 minutes of video, but I was there for hours. Right, I talked to dozens and dozens of people, and then you cut that down and clip that out for your final product. And I can just say this, I talked to a number of people who were driving, you know, the Lexus or the Mercedes, and it was just kind of a cool thing for them. They're like, oh, awesome, some cheap gas. I heard about this on the radio. But, you know, they were the small, small minority. We were actually, so this happened in Grand Rapids, where I live now. It happened over by Division Street. And for folks that don't know Grand Rapids, I would say that is a majority-minority neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so about 90% of the people I interacted with were not white. And they were almost all either retirees on fixed incomes, because this event was held in the middle of the day, or stay-at-home moms really struggling to make it. And I was just really struck by how emotional and candid and personal this was to people. The lines, people waited in line for hours, up to 2 hours to get this gas. And so it was really a moving experience for me to see, you know, this is what real America is struggling with and cares about right now.
What was the most heartbreaking story you heard?
Well, I think that it would have to be the woman, and maybe this is in the grand scheme of things not heartbreaking, but she was telling me that now she'll have enough money to take her grandkids out this weekend. And I just made me really sad, because I'm like, she literally, the difference of $40 is going to make the difference if she would have had to sit at home and not take them out for something. And I'm like, how sad is that? But what a poignant example of how inflation is so hard for people at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. You know, I'm a journalist. I work remote. I was never really affected by this. And I think so were, everyone is a little bit, right? But I had it much easier than most. And so are most of the people who work in mainstream media. And that's why it is, you know, you talked about that Monmouth poll, the disparity between the priorities of the public. You know, the top priorities for the mainstream media are things like LGBT, abortion, COVID. Those all have like 1%, 3%,
right.
5% in that poll. Gas prices, inflation, economy. That's what people actually care about. And that was my big takeaway talking to them.
Well right. And the trade-off that you were just describing, the grandma saying, can I take my kids out or do I have to fill up the tank so that I can, you know, whatever, get to work or get them to the places and so forth. You know, those real world trade-offs, they're not sexy. They don't engender hysteria. And so they don't get much attention from people who are otherwise insulated from them. And they're not, you know, cataclysmic. This isn't a sub-Saharan Africa, but it's still about quality of life. And people shouldn't be criticized or dismissed because they have real anxiety about the quality of their life deteriorating and looking like it's going to deteriorate yet for some time to come.
Oh, I completely agree, especially when we're told other people are aggrieved by pronouns or microaggressions.
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
Actually, I think this stuff is what matters. I spoke to another woman who is the mother of a special needs child and has to drive her son 30 minutes each way to a school that's right for him. And guess what? I think Michigan has pretty good school choice, so that might be a part of that. But she told me that it was just absolutely bankrupting her towards the end of the year to drive there and back every day, and that she was really worried about going back in the fall if gas prices are this high, if she's going to be able to get her kid to the school that's right for him. And that was really heartbreaking to me as well.
Do they know who did this? I mean, do they know that it's President Biden's fault and not Putin's fault? Because I was at a gas giveaway with Willie Wilson and I was trying to, you know, get inside their heads. Like, well, do you know why this is happening? And most people said it was Putin's fault.
Yeah, exactly. That's the big problem. We were there to raise awareness and let people know, you know, $2.38, that's what it was when Biden took over. And a few people that I talked to gave Biden some share of the blame. But most of them said either, I don't know, or they said, well, I think it's the war in Ukraine. And then I would explain to them, you know, well, actually, gas prices had increased a whole dollar before the war even started. And I do think the war has definitely contributed to the increase. But we can't sit here and pretend that all of Biden's anti-energy policies, canceling pipelines, blocking leases, promising to they're going to end fossil fuels, like that's not going to affect the animal spirits of the market. Of course it is. Of course it's going to drive up prices. They put billions of dollars of regulations on the energy sector at the worst possible time. So I think we were there to try to explain to people because, unfortunately, a lot of them don't understand. A lot of people implicitly blame the president, but very few people I talked to actually directly or knew specifically what he had done. So I think that's an opportunity for us. It's obviously a failing of the mainstream media, but it's also an opportunity for people like us to educate and raise awareness. And that's what Americans for Prosperity is doing a really great job with at these nationwide gas giveaways. So they're doing them in all sorts of places across the country. And the idea is to help people, but also to educate them and give them the information that they need to, you know, actually achieve change in what Washington is doing right now that's so harmful.
You also wrote about freeing Britney, no, not Spears, the other one, the one in Russia, and since you brought up Russia. Her partner spoke to CNN over the weekend. She wasn't really too pleased from the response she's gotten from this administration, the State Department, to this point.
We need more women in position.
Where's Brit? Oh, do we have her? Well, anyway, she was complaining that the administration is not doing everything that she thinks it can do. Then we had subsequent to that interview, you had Brittany Griner apparently get a handwritten note to the Biden administration. And now Joe and Jill are on the case. But you're talking about it's been sort of surprisingly low profile for a high profile female athlete who's been detained for something like 140 days right now and is facing 10 years in prison with in a country that is one of America's leading adversaries. And we just haven't heard that much about it, relatively speaking, including from sports journalists. I just find the relative lack of coverage sort of interesting.
Yeah, I find it interesting, but also disturbing, because in my view, I mean, I think she's essentially a political prisoner at this point. They're keeping her. So they arrested her before the invasion of Ukraine, a few weeks before. But at this point, keeping her imprisoned over two personal size, less than 1 gram or whatever the metric is, things of hashish oil, not even like actual marijuana. Should she have brought that into Russia? No. Stupid. Dumb. She broke the law. Sure. But she should get a fine. She should. I mean, I think a Russian citizen who committed that offense would be looking at months in prison. But they're trumping up these charges to give her 10 years. I think they're just doing this to get leverage over the United States.
No question. There's no question. Sure. I mean, but it's right now it's like she's going to have to midnight express her way out of there.
But Biden, somebody asked me recently, would it be different if Trump was president? And I kind of was torn on it. I think Trump would either be raising heck right now, or he would be saying, well, you kneeled for the anthem and hate America so much, deal with it. But the difference is Biden is just inept and weak and not taken seriously. I mean, oh no, what's he going to do to Putin? Talk about random stories with Corn Pop again?
Yeah, well, or Corn Trump. I think just because of the celebrity, I mean, in part because of the celebrity nature of it, and because it's just sort of a great jujitsu to the left. Oh, I'm this, I'm such a bad guy, I'm this and I'm that. Well, I'm going to get Brittany Griner back in America where she belongs. And I'm going to threaten to blow up Moscow if she's not released or something like that, which wouldn't surprise me either. I think he would be making a big issue of this. Like he did with
Kim Jong-un.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But also the sports press corps, too, that normally is so ready to fold in with the D.C. press corps and engage in the same sort of cheap moralizing. And they're nowhere to be heard on this. Fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting some coverage, but it's just not the story that it seems to be. You know, what's really interesting is I'm sure you guys have social media people who do this, but I look at what's being searched on social media and what has lots of content about it. Mm-hmm. And Brittany Griner is extremely high search, but very low competition. There's very little actually being posted or produced about it, which makes it an opportunity for people who want to create content on it. But that's really weird to me. I honestly don't understand. Like, she should be very sympathetic to them. I think it might just be that her continued detainment is an embarrassment to the Biden administration, and they just carry water for this White House. But I honestly don't know, because, like, they're all about, you know, racial injustice and the war on drugs being bad. And I agree with some of it, right? But she's like the prototypical example of a black woman wrongfully imprisoned by a tyrannical government over no trumped up charges or whatever. It seems like the left or the woke narrative should care about this, but it's really, really muted, the outrage and the coverage.
So if it was LeBron James or Steph Curry, do you think they'd be back here by now?
I don't know. I mean, they are just bigger celebrities than Brittany Griner, to be honest, and with much more commercial value than her. So maybe the cynical part of me thinks maybe they would. But yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, again, so the Trump thing is fascinating because LiAngelo Ball, Cody Riley, Jalen Hill, when they were arrested in China and for shoplifting, right?
Oh, so goofy. Stupid.
Trump helped them secure the release, right, and their repatriation. He was even thanked by LiAngelo Ball. And then, you know, there was the effort by the D.C. press corps to downplay his involvement. He's only the president of the United States, right? He wasn't involved. That's what happened in a parallel circumstance with, mm-hmm, you know, another major adversary of the United States at a time when there was, you know, trade war drums being beaten. And so I think that comparison of what he did for those basketball players versus what's the Biden administration has done or not done for Griner is very interesting and very difficult for the left to countenance.
Yeah, I agree. And I just think it's another reason why Biden is has what, a 30% approval rating
yes,
now?
Yes, yes, yeah. Right. Weakness is provocative. Brad Palumbo, policy correspondent for Fee, contributor to the Washington Examiner and co-founder of Based Politics. Brad, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So as to the question, how could you have police called to your home, have knives taken away because your son threatened to kill family members, and then as his father, a few months later, sponsor him for a FOID card at the age of 19. But the proximity between that incident and sponsoring him for a FOID card so he could purchase his own weapons is the question. And
it's three months later.
And the father's answer is what?
Well, he was on Good Morning America, and he, you know, first talked about how they're devastated.
I love my son, but it's devastating to everyone involved.
And then he talked about, you know, what he did with the FOID card. Hey, Justin, can you play two? I'm having a hard time here with the computer.
I filled out the consent form to allow my son to go through the process. They do background checks, whatever that entails.
And
but that's not an answer.
That's not an answer.
We know what
these
the process
are all
is.
Non-answer answers.
This has taken us by complete surprise. 3 days before the 4th, my wife had asked him, hey, do you have any plans for the 4th? And he simply said no.
Yeah. Okay. Since he's doing Good Morning America and he's talking to the New York Post, can we get him on this show so some adult can ask him adult questions and get actual responses? That those are not responses, particularly when he says in this interview he gave to the Post, he talked to his son just a few hours before he committed that atrocity against the people of Highland Park, and he said his son said. They were talking about this Danish guy who shot and killed three people outside a mall at a mall outside of Copenhagen on Sunday. And his son said, yeah, that guy's an idiot. That's what he said. Father recalling what son said. He said his son said people like that commit mass shootings to amp up the people that want to ban all guns. I talked to him 13 hours before the massacre on Monday. That's why I guess I'm in such shock. Like, did he have a psychiatric break or something? Question mark. The father asked rhetorically, but he then went on to say that he treated his collection of knives as like how he used to collect coins and baseball cards, that he was going to hold his head up high. I'm going to stay here. I hold my head up high because I didn't do anything wrong. And his attorney, Steve Greenberg, saying that he didn't see anything. The family didn't see anything because there was nothing to see. But that's just not true.
No.
And
it's lies and more damn lies.
Well,
and now people are dead.
Or cover your ass, whatever it is. It's just not true. And you could say one thing in isolation, okay. But we have a disturbing mural painted on the side of his mom's house. Her house. We have his profile and the things he was doing playing video games, Call of Duty in particular. We have the songs and the music videos. We have the incident at the home. We have what some things are positive. A girl that worked for him at Panera Bread says she was shocked. He was a polite guy. She never had an issue with him. She couldn't believe when she heard the police were looking for him on July 4th. So you have some mitigating. You have a guy that we talked to who officed above the deli that the father owned, who said like that he's a good guy, he's not a bad guy, but he's also, that same friend is also upset with some of the things the father is saying because he knows it doesn't square with what we all know based on what is in the public domain right now.
I mean, I know he's leery of litigation, but just come clean and have other parents learn from your mistakes, your deadly mistakes that you made. Why on the earth would you give him such power? I mean, he had five weapons that he's bought at different times, and he passed a background check every time, even though Highland Park Police sent a clear and present danger report to Illinois State Police.
Yeah, well, people want to put that on Illinois State Police. I mean, it's the standards for green lighting or red lighting a application are the standards. You want to talk about changing the standards. You want to talk about changing the information that state police have access to and that can use in making a decision as to whether or not to approve an application or not. And the same thing at the federal level, since this is sort of redundancy here at the state level. Fine. Yes. But let's just be careful about, you know, who we're implicating as party to this and on what basis.
And he could have killed more. I mean, he drove to Madison, Wisconsin, after shooting 83 rounds off, hitting 45 here in Highland Park.
When he drove to Madison, he was driving around. However, he did see a celebration that was occurring in Madison, and he seriously contemplated using the firearm he had in his vehicle to commit another shooting in Madison.
Do you know how much ammunition he had at that point?
Approximately 60 rounds. Yes.
60.
Yes.
What about his motivation for the attack in the first place?
His motivation isn't necessarily clear. I don't want to go specifically into what he told investigators. However, he had some type of affinity towards the number 4 and 7, and inverse was 7-4.
And that was the date, and they said that he didn't get out of his car in Madison because he hadn't planned out the attack through.
Well, that's another aspect of it. He's an adult by age. But he's living in close proximity to his father, and this was planned for some time. And so nothing out of the ordinary or whatever constituted ordinary in that relationship. And this, and by the way, includes mom, too. As I said, a mural, a disturbing mural, something you'd see in a horror movie painted on her home. So it's like there was nothing. Nobody saw anything because there was nothing to see. That's not true. So, right. So then don't give me a process answer to a judgment question. We're trying to get to judgment with respect to mom and dad. And we have a media that's not quite helping us get there at this point. Doug and McHenry, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
And Amy, how you doing? Quick question. From the time that he left that building dressed like a woman, how did they identify him so fast? Because I was kind of listening to this all day long on Monday.
Well, I think there's a combination of things. Thanks for the call. One, they had a weapon from the scene with a serial number that traced back to the purchaser. Mm-hmm. Two is there were eyewitnesses, because almost immediately, I mean, I remember the coming over the transom at about 10:15 or 10:20 in the morning. And then almost within the hour, there was talk of looking for a white man, 18 to 20, with long black hair. So somebody saw something and reported what they saw. And then there's this issue of DNA, which we don't exactly know how they matched DNA from the gun to him before he was in custody, if that's actually the timeline of what happened. I'm still unclear on that. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Dan, about the parents. We now know, generally speaking, what the warning signs are, and people have to start, family, friends of these individuals, have to start reporting them to the police or at least taking notice of it. At the same time, he was 21 at the time of the attack, which means he very easily could have gotten the FOID card by himself and gotten the guns all by himself. But like I said, I didn't know what you're saying.
Well, right.
I mean, he got it when he was 19.
You know. Well, I know, but you're saying he didn't commit the violence when he was 19. He committed it now that he's 22. And so he could have waited all this time and been plotting all this time to be 21 or 22 if he didn't already have the FOIA card, get it and do the same thing. No, I hear what you're saying. That's right, Bill. But of course, that still doesn't, I mean, the fact.
Well, it doesn't excuse the parents.
Exactly. It still doesn't explain what the thinking was and what the willful blindness was, if anybody wants to cop to that, with respect to him over the last several years. And you had this girl that worked with him at Panera who chose to remain nameless, but she talked to the press and she said that he was a different person after the COVID lockdown and the Panera Bread shut down, and then he was out of a job. And she said he was different than the person that she worked with at Panera. So, you know, factor that additional isolation into everything else, including, by the way, allegations of heavy marijuana use. And we've talked about that a little bit, too. So, I mean, this is a multivariate equation here, but certainly the parents are part of it.
And now that we generally know what these shooters' IDs, you know, backgrounds are, so people should start waking up when they have an individual like this and start thinking deeper about how they may need to help these people before they reach that point and what they need to be doing in case they really have an issue. I mean, it's not a mystery anymore. It's not like it's the first one. So they should, family and friends and the police and mental health professionals should already be on this, you know, to help prevent the next one.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. Well, we talked to that that gentleman, Stephen Levin, at the top of the 6 o'clock hour this morning, and he said to us that after the police came to the home, that the father said to him, "I need to get my son some help." And we haven't heard any reporting that his son ever got any psychiatric care, was on any psychiatric drugs. I haven't seen anything on that, but it would be good to know. And since the father's talking, it'd be nice if somebody freaking asked him,
right.
did you ever seek help? Was he under psychiatric care at any point in time?
Yeah, after the suicide incident, and then after when he threatened everybody in your family that he was going to kill him. Did you take him to get help? Was he seen a counselor or something?
What to your knowledge, was he on any psychiatric drugs at the time of the shooting?
And then did that interfere or mix with his marijuana use?
Art in Woodstock.
We need to get him on the show.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I'm wondering if because his dad was running for mayor in 2019, if that's why there was no record of all this other crazy stuff.
No.
You know, of him committing suicide. You don't think that they did that to keep his dad's name clean?
Thanks for the call, Art, and we got you on the Munchkin line there, sorry. But no, because the 2019 municipal election occurred prior to those incidents in the fall of 2019. So that election was already over. Phil, Northwest Side.
Morning, guys. I was wondering if this guy ever threatened our Supreme Court justices and how that plays out in the Foyd card for our mayor. And I was also wondering...
She doesn't need a Foyd card. She's got 60 police officers.
I know. With the same assault rifles. I was also curious, did that guy's father, did he run under a Democrat or Republican ticket?
It's a nonpartisan municipal election. Thanks for the call. I think, though, I got to check this out, but somebody told me that in filings with the Illinois State Board of Elections, he identified as a Democrat, but his vote history just has him voting in a couple of municipal elections, no primaries. So I don't know, but I don't know. Could a Republican, somebody who's known to be a Republican get 28% of the vote in Highland Park? Probably not. Linda in Bloomingdale.
Hi. After the incident with the knives and the sword in the home and threatening the family, not one of those family members pressed charges. Had one of them pressed charges, would that not have been on his record when he went to apply for a Foyd card?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Anybody filed that
there
complaint.
You go.
Yep, they brought it
there
to
you
him.
There you go.
They didn't want to file charges.
Thanks, Linda. Well, I mean, it would have been on his record had he been convicted.
No, if he was charged, I think.
You would think what?
I thought if you were charged with something rather than convicted, it still shows up when they do a background check, doesn't it?
It says this, if you're acquitted of the charge, that does not count against you in with respect to your constitutional rights by definition, okay. Right? I mean, of course not. So if he was charged, but I mean, ostensibly you expect if they had pressed charges, then he either would have been convicted because you've got eyewitnesses or he would have more likely pled out and there would have been maybe some alternative sentencing if he got treatment. And then all of that stuff would have been. So that's more likely how it would have played out had they pressed charges. But this, again, is where I don't understand, because on the one hand, the father says it was like a childhood prank in this interview he gave to the New York Post. And he relegates the knife collection to like a coin collection. On the other hand, according to the friend that we spoke with this morning, he said after the incident, I got to get my son some help. So,
and by the way, he told police
something doesn't match up.
He told police those knives and the dagger and the sword were his so that his son could get his weapons back. That's what Highland, that's what, you know, the authorities said yesterday.
So I mean, there's a lot of things that don't sync up here that still need clarity or, you know, what we still need to understand. There are things that are mutually exclusive. It was either one or the other, and we don't know which because we're hearing both suggestions. David in Winnetka.
Yeah, hi. This is going to sound out there, but for some reason, the guy that shot John Lennon, you know, these nutjob types, the slightest little slight could set them off. And I read somewhere recently that, I think recently he tried to get into a synagogue that didn't permit him to go in. And
he was in a synagogue. He was in a synagogue or around it, and the rabbi told him to leave because he recognized him as not part of the community. Yeah,
correct. And I think that little slight might have been the trigger that set off his mental illness to, you know.
Well, I mean, that was back. Thanks for the call, David. I mean, that was a few months ago now during Passover, according to the rabbi of that congregation. I don't know what set him off or what was going on. I mean, you know, imponderable. Who knows? Grant in Rockford.
Good morning, you two. A good combo. I think, you know, the drug thing is a big deal. If they're on these prescription drugs, I feel like that's a cancer on itself. But who is buying these weapons? How is a kid who works at Panera, I get it, he lives at home, how are they spending this money? The psychopath up in Buffalo, he had thousands of dollars of weaponry. Who's buying this stuff for him? His dad bought it all?
His dad said to ABC News that his son bought the weapons himself. But it was a Smith & Wesson, a Glock handgun, a Caltech rifle, Remington rifle, and a shotgun.
Yeah, so
I mean, you just rattled off several thousand dollars worth of firearms, and they had the one in New York had body armor. I mean, where are these guys getting? It's all fishy. I don't know.
Well, Grant, it's a fair point you raise. I think thanks for the call. That's another question for the dad is how was he financing this? Maybe he's living in this flat rent free, and so his living expenses are limited. But we also have, and I don't know, because this suggestion was made before the other day, and again, and the guy we spoke with this morning mentioned this too, that a couple of these rap songs and videos that he made had like a million streams or downloads, and so he could have made, you know, some money, some significant money, or in his teenage years because of the music stuff that he was doing. We don't know. That's a question that would be good to get an answer to as well, because it certainly speaks to moral culpability, if not also legal. Philip in Skokie.
Yes, this guy had a lot of time apparently to plan this. And if he was that meticulous, he could just as easily have planned a bombing as they did at the Boston Marathon. Just gun laws are not the way not the thing that you have to only concentrate on. This was an intended, planned out attack, and this guy could have just have easily figured out other ways to have harmed large numbers of people.
Yeah.
That's all.
Thanks, Philip. Larry Carol Stream.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. The comment about the DNA, I was glued to Fox TV all afternoon Sunday, the national thing, not the Chicago channel. And the reporter mentioned it was late in the afternoon, 4 or 4:30, that they had the identity because, among other pieces of evidence, the kid had recently had a COVID test for some
reason. That doesn't wash. I don't think so. If that's true, then we have a much bigger story, because the DNA from the COVID test, the government is not supposed to have it where it matches up to a particular individual.
You are absolutely correct on that headache.
Right.
Have a good day.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Larry. So if there's truth to that, then we got a lot bigger story about another aspect to this story that's a story in and of itself in terms of warehousing DNA that's identified to particular individuals who took COVID tests. But I don't, there's no reason to believe that's true. I think that's a lot of supposition at this point. Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you know, I'm listening, and I understand your point with everything that you've been talking about. First off, kudos to that interview with Cass there. I mean, hopefully he'll come on again, you know. But what I'm saying is, with all these Pride months and that, I say we should have open carry in Illinois. And that's my thing, because, granted, maybe open carry wouldn't have helped what had just happened in both instances with the motorist running away and having 60 shots fired at him and most of them landing.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.